yet another episode of When a Guy Has a Really Fucked Gender. As always, I'm your host, Jolene, and joined this week by returning guests. I love it when we get someone back on the podcast. And also, I think you were like the, I guess depending on how you count it, like third or fourth guest ever, because you were the first two for episode. Ilya from episode 3, going way back to the beginnings.
Hello, I'm excited to talk about something other than my own gender.
yes, this is, I need to come up with like a name for when I'm doing the episodes that aren't really like about a person's gender, but are sort of like, you know, like I had the neuroendocrinology episode, or like the, I don't know, or the animal facts. I didn't come up with like a name for that. I don't know what to call them. If you have any ideas, audience, please, you know, just at me, give me suggestions for the sub series name or what have you. But that's enough meta conversation. We're here to talk about an article you wrote, and I guess kind of the. we're going to talk about both sort of, I guess, some of the like methodological things about the article, because I think it's a really interesting and good article methodologically, and it makes like it presents like a sort of what I think is like a useful generalizable argument, I guess, and also then some of the, I guess, specifics, and then maybe some stuff kind of beyond that tied to, I guess, the article is specifically about Byzantine history, but you were saying in the, you're getting ready for this, that a lot of your favorite stuff is actually sort of like pre-Byzantine.
Yeah. So in terms of introducing the article, like one of the weird things about how it came about is I'm not a Byzantine historian, and I'm actually not a medieval historian by training at all.
Are you a historian?
I am a historian.
Okay.
So, and this is relevant to the methodology, which is why I'm giving this. But so I was doing a master's in cultural history during lockdown in the UK. I know that like people had very different experiences of how much lockdown there was, but for me it was like I was spending a lot of time in my house. And my original dissertation was about something entirely different. I was looking at folklore, revivalism, and fascism in interwar Britain.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem was that the person who was my supervisor for that dissertation, who was also the head of my course and my personal tutor, was, I guess, like had a very middle ground position on the big British gender debate. And I sort of rapidly realized that I didn't necessarily want to be working with her on anything to do with, well, especially anything to do with gender, which was always, you know, I was writing about fascism, I was going to be writing about gender. But there was someone who taught, I think, like one class that I'd really, really enjoyed, Marula Perisonidi, who is a fantastic Byzantinist, who I have to admit, you know, as I'm going to sing her praises, is also now a close personal friend, but like I didn't know her at the time. She worked on Byzantine history, and she taught one really, really interesting class on gender in Byzantium. And like, I, at the point when I decided I wasn't going to drop out of my master's, decided I needed to change dissertation supervisor. And of course, that meant I kind of had to change topic. And so I just pivoted entirely into Byzantine trans history in order to have someone who I liked and trusted to supervise me. Yeah, that's, so I wrote this master's dissertation that became this article a year after I was meant to, having got a sort of an extension due to like all of the classic, you know, like transitioning, housing insecurity, so on reasons. And one of the problems I had on my master's was because I was doing it remotely, and I was doing it sort of initially in lockdown, and then we got out of lockdown, and I started dating the person who's still my girlfriend, who is like a really, really lovely, cool person. And I lost the ability at the point when we started seeing each other to like go into that headspace where I was like collapsed, like pretending not to care about the dignity of trans people. Like, where I lost the ability to like write as though I was writing for someone who thought that we should all die, which was
a frustratingly important skill when you're writing philosophy, or not philosophy, but when you're writing academically, it's sort of
So I spent like a couple of weeks just hanging out with T, who like is, you know, now my all-time favorite person in the universe, and like I realized over the course of that time that I wasn't writing my essay, which was due at the end of the weekend after those 2 weeks, and I just didn't write that essay. And then over the weekend I wrote the essay, and it was for a different module. It was something to do with early modern history, but it had a set title, and it was about the history of cross-dressing in early modern Europe. And I was so angry with all of the literature, and also I'd left myself so little time to write it because I'd been having fun with other trans people, that I just wrote about everything I hated about the setup of being asked the question in the first place. And I think that is kind of the origin of the methodology that I brought to Byzantine studies.
Yeah.
Because the article we're discussing, Selective Historians, is kind of about looking at the ways that cisness is functioning in any kind of academic sphere.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's a... So yeah, the article, the full title, there'll be a link down in the description. I guess we should say the full title, Selective Historians, The Construction of Cisness in Byzantine and Byzantinist Tests by Ilya Maud. There'll be a link to that. It is available. You won't need to you don't need to go to like LibGen or what the fuck, Sci-Hub, any of that. It's just the PDF's just available.
Because I had an admin job at Leicester Medical School.
Shout out to this is in Gender and History, is the journal this is published in. The sort of, I guess the way that I would kind of, if I were to kind of shortly sum up the, and I think this is a thing that I've probably even said on the podcast before, right? I think about this as an approach frequently to questions about like, oh, is X, Y, or Z, you know, person, category, type of person, whatever, cis, is, or are they trans? I think sometimes, well, what would be the sort of political valence of calling them cis? Or like, what are we kind of insisting upon if we say that they're cis? And I guess you can say like, oh, well, I guess maybe we'll sort of get to the kind of question about like, are those the only two options? Later, that's sort of bracket that question for now, but I think that's like a really kind of useful way to approach these sorts of things, at least. That is basically a kind of an extremely short version of what the article, at least as I understood it, was kind of doing.
I like that read of it, because I think like when I was writing it, I didn't originally set out to write a sort of methodological article, but there's one book that is explicitly about trans-Byzantine history that that I'm aware of that currently exists, which is Byzantine Intersectionality, and that is by Roland Bethencourt, and it's a really, really good book that is also predictably, because it's trying to do something for the first time, wrong in some really, really annoying ways. And I wanted to write about the stuff that came up in that book, and the more I started writing about it, the more I realized I had to write about the context of it. And it wasn't really fair to be focusing on the one, you know, like the one person actually trying to do trans-Byzantine history in the field, and being like, well, you're getting all of these things wrong. And that's how it expanded out to being about it has a sort of three case studies of three different historians and the ways that I read them, at least, as reinforcing the hegemonic power of cisness in their reading of the Byzantine world. And yeah, it was originally, I think, if I remember rightly, focused around just one of them, but it was focused around the best of those historians, in my opinion. and it started to feel really unfair that I was just writing this article that was just really being quite mean about someone who was trying really hard to do something no one else was doing.
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, it's sort of, sometimes when I notice this in myself, I sort of, you know, we'll say like, oh, this is like, you know, narcissism of small differences or something like that. Because I do think that there is something about when someone is so close, but just, you know, making like a couple missteps or like has like a couple like hang-ups or holdovers that you're like, you just need to like get over this and then you'll be completely right. That is so much more frustrating than when someone is just like, I mean, yeah, like some of these people that you're talking about are just like, or some of these other, I think, historians are just like, transphobic. Like, and I think that's sort of, you know, kind of placing the kind of the person that's at least trying in contiguity with that is demonstrative and useful and I hope well received. It seems to me like it's a good sort of practice academically. It's definitely how I would do something like this, but yeah
and I that is a question that's been in my mind, because I was talking to someone at there was like, I can't remember the name of it, unfortunately, because my memory is like that, but I was talking to someone at a vaguely trans studies-ish conference in Birmingham a few months ago about writing about Byzantium, and the person I was talking to asked, oh, you know, have you come across Roland Bettencourt's work? And I was like, oh yeah, well, you know, I'm quite critical of them, actually. And I got this really sort of withering stare back, and the person I was talking to was saying, well, you know, should maybe be a bit careful about sort of being critical about the people who are trying to do this work in the field, because and who already have academic jobs. And it was like a sort of, it was, I love the sort of like one-two side of like, on the one hand, it's you know, that sort of very reasonable question of like, how are you approaching other, you know, queer historians trying their best at writing this kind of history and trying to work through all of these layers of what they are allowed to write and what they're able to, you know, even think in that setting. And then on the other hand, you have, and these people could stop you from getting jobs.
Right, yeah. And it's always, right, I mean, I think, you know, I've been lucky that I've known a lot of academics whose approach to this person disagrees with me really vigorously has been to really try to promote that person's career and to sort of bring them sort of to like there was one professor at my the department that I no longer affiliated with, but who was constantly sort of like you know, sending out invitations to people that were quite critical of him to, like, you know, come to conferences or like sort of, you know, come to his class and do all this stuff. He was really, I mean, part of it was that he wanted to argue with them and try to convince them that he was right. But I think he was also, you know, understood, like, I want to make sure I'm understanding them as best as I can. And I want to, like, you know, so that there are people out there. I think it's, I don't know, maybe not necessarily wise from a career perspective to hope that that's people's approach, but it definitely is not, like, not everyone is just, you know, sort of out for themselves.
Well, fortunately, I have no intention of being a Byzantinist.
Okay.
I wrote this article. I've written one more that's actually coming out very soon. I co-wrote that one with Marula, who was my supervisor at the time. They wrote this dissertation, and that's sort of exploring more in the direction of like laying this out as a methodology. And it takes it a bit further in terms of the question of, you know, what do you do when you're writing about a specific person, and there are trans readings of that person. And so one historical figure who comes up in this article, I believe, I'm just going to control F my own writing now, is Michael Thelos, the 11th century intellectual. Yeah, that was me reading and trying to remember what I put. So me and Marula ended up writing a article that is coming out soon. One of the things that started it was this question of what pronouns she uses when writing about Michael Thelos. And I think the pronouns thing is really interesting, because It is the most annoying question in trans history, and it produces the most annoying answers. But I think the things that are annoying about it are very productive to thought. So in Byzantine Intersectionality, Roland Bethencourt reads Michael Thelos as this non-binary figure. And they're sort of their reading is coming from, I think, two points in Thelos's writing where, and I'm going to they them Michael Thelos for the purposes of this, where they say, where they describe themselves as having a feminine nature. And what, so the problem this presented for Marulla was that she was writing a book about scholarly masculinities in which Michael Thelos had been the sort of the, one of the central figures she was analyzing. Because of the ways that Thelos sort of leveraged certain parts of the imagery of the scholar in order to justify their deviation from sort of normal, appropriate masculine norms and to justify it as more masculine. And I don't think that's a read against reading Thelos as non-binary, but it sort of opened up this question of what happens when what you're looking at is actually the way someone is navigating cisness and surviving under cisness and doing different kinds of gender transgression under cisness, and how are they having to narrate that? And the thing that really acutely creates that is that is something that Marulla showed me, which is that Thelos wrote about a trans child quite extensively and very, very negatively. So there is this, and so in the article that, again, I should be coming out actually in the next few weeks, excitingly, in Past and Present, I'll be putting it up on Twitter when it comes out. It should also be open access. In the article that me and Marulla have written together, we look at Thelos's description of this trans child, and this very conspicuously trans child, and the way that the writing is sort of simultaneously trying to justify why she is the way she is, you know, because it's talking about how she refuses to play boys' games, refuses to sing the songs boys sing, but will only sing the songs the girls sing. And Thelos is sort of trying to come up with an explanation for what could have made her that way, and ends up reaching for disability in a really, really noticeable way, and ends up sort of saying, well, maybe her head's too big, and so her soul isn't concentrated enough, and that's why she's sort of, and I think he says, and therefore the outbreath of the soul is weak and feminine, so we end up writing about Thelos as this figure who is simultaneously desiring these things outside of a Byzantine cis masculinity, and doing these things outside of that, and understanding themselves outside of that, and also distancing themselves from someone else who is doing something that's more conspicuously feminine and is more sort of conspicuously unacceptable. And I think by looking at that, we end up being forced to look at actually how, if you're reading someone as navigating cisness, the question of is this figure trans or is this figure cis is often the answer to both of those things is yes.
Right. Yeah. No. Yeah. That's exactly. And I mean that's also right. The sort of trans person who is like a bit of a gender cop about another trans person who is more that is like such a like recognizable, like we all know that person, you know,
literally.
She's fucking annoying and I wish she'd stop, but you know, we've all also been that person at, you know, some point in our life. That's probably exactly. Like one of the not to be like trans historical, but that is but yeah, no, I think that's a really good sort of way to frame it, is because it is right, sort of like all, you know, extremely contextual. It is all sort of like right. The question of are they cis or are they trans, it can be sort of this both and, because and that's a good way, I think, to sort of, you know, clarify that these are categories that we are sort of reading back, but also the sort of process of reading those back isn't, you know, when we abstract away both sort of cisness and transness, the thing that is sort of like, or when we sort of bracket both cisness and transness as, you know, sort of like 21st century inventions of ways of understanding gender, the thing that's left behind is not going to be exactly what we imagine, because I think, you know, those categories are so close to us, those categories are so defining for us for the way that we think. But it's definitely not going to be just sort of like, I think you say like a prelapsarian cisness or something. In the article. That's not what's going to be left. And so I think it's important to sort of, I guess think about that and sort of foreground that in your, in our understandings.
And I think that sort of brings up something that I'm not 100% sure I'm right about, but I am quite passionate about, which is thinking of cisness as like a type of social control rather than the particular nature of the social control. Like thinking of it as like a structure that can look very, very different in different contexts. Because I went into this, I think I was being annoyed at these historians, right? That was I went into this being annoyed at historians, and I ended up finding so many weird, interesting things in the text that they were writing about. And I kept feeling like the thing I was finding was this, just the incredible, intense social power of the demand that you sort of conform to appropriate gender, even if what that appropriate gender looked like or what the categories of it were very different, and even if the shape of sort of what falling out of the bottom of it would look like was different as well. And then also, obviously, you also have those things that do have the just very intense present day resonances. I one of my favorite things on the internet is the Internet Medieval Sourcebook, and that is, despite I'm not a medieval historian by trade, as I keep protesting. But I go on the Internet Medieval Sourcebook, and if you go into the sort of section on LGBT history, there are some really, really fun like captioning decisions that have been made around different sources. So one of my favorites, and I brought it up for this, because I think I do cite it in that article, but I didn't get to go into it as much as I wanted to, because I would have just, it required foregrounding I didn't have space to do, is this source from the early Christian theologian, Clement of Alexandria, who is sort of like circa 200 AD, who's writing about gender, and he's writing about effeminacy. And there's this bit where he describes women who consort with effeminates. And the Internet Medieval Sourcebook has captioned this in a way that can only recall the fag hags of pre-Stonewall New York. And I love that. I love what's happened there. Because there are also these bits of sort of Byzantine gender or pre-Byzantine gender here that are just shockingly evocative of the present as well. Like, and I've been searching for this source for a while, and I had a source and I can't remember where I found it. This one is pending. But I remember reading a source that was complaining about men apparently growing their hair long and dyeing it blonde in Byzantium using lemon juice and sunlight.
Okay.
And there's two things I love about this. One is like, they're just like, it's exactly the same thing that they're mad at. But, like, it's so like evocative of like of the present. But it's also the lemon juice thing, because it just makes me think of 90s teen magazines. Like, it's the same technology. And they get really mad. There's another, like, a consistent theme in loads of sources is being really, really mad about body hair removal, and specifically body hair removal by effeminate, yeah, as a category. And there's a great bit of one of the sort of Clement of Alexandria, theological advisory writing. I don't know how I describe this, but where he talks about the fact that you could barely tell the difference between these effeminates and women because of their body hair removal and their long hair, which again, it's just like, I don't know how I feel about how similar what this guy is mad at to what, you know, a lot of people are mad at now. but it's very evocative. And I ended up I haven't written a thing about this yet, but I'm keeping a folder of all of the sort of like specific complaints about different bodily alterations and sort of bodily care practices in Byzantium, because it could really be like written up. Like, I kind of want to make a zine in the style of a 90s magazine. That's what I'm thinking here, but just with Byzantine stuff.
That sounds amazing. I would love to see that. That should 100%. Yeah. That should 100% exist. I love that.
I really like the Byzantine stuff as like a thinking tool.
As a what tool?
A thinking tool.
Oh yeah.
Because this is one of the ways in which I'm not really like, I'm not a proper medieval historian, because I'm not going into this terribly concerned with like, I guess what I can do for the long dead. I'm much more interested in what the long dead can do for me. Mm-hmm. and sometimes there is some sort of text that I read that has like really radically altered the way I think about the present. And I'm not sure like how much this is particularly relevant to what they actually say about the past, because you know how in like Foucault's, is it Madness and Civilization, he talks a bunch about leper colonies, and most of what he says isn't true, but he makes some really interesting points based on it.
That just sounds like a lot of Foucault's work.
Yeah, exactly. Or like Federici, like Caliban and the Witch. It's just like, A, there are issues there. B, 90% of that history is bullshit.
Right.
But it's being used as a thinking tool. Or like, I kind of wish theorists were more willing to say that was what we were doing, but like,
yeah, it's a much more interesting, I think that the internet has really ruined our ability to just kind of bullshit. Because with like Foucault, right? Like there's I remember I took a class on Foucault when I was an undergrad, and the professor told this story about someone asking Foucault, like, oh, like, you know, what should I be reading if I want to be like producing work like yours? And I forget what the exact institution Foucault answer with, but basically he was like, you just need to go to the like the National Library of France. This was in France. He's just go to the National Library and start reading. Just like go pick, which is so great because it's like that is pretty clearly like how he's doing his research. It's like you're not gonna go fucking pick a book like a random 17th century like medical textbook off the wall and be like, that's not what they said in there. Or even if it is what they said in there, like, what does that fucking have to do with, like, what, you know, people were actually doing or actual history or anything like that? You don't fucking know that. That's sort of like a, but that's kind of beyond the point. That's not necessarily strictly relevant, you know, whether or not that, and I mean, even, I don't know, what I said is probably just apocryphal and wrong in some way, but like, you know, yeah.
I really think like my problem is I'm very interested in what people said, but I'm not actually that interested in how much it related to what people were actually doing, because it's like I love like early Christian writers, but it's not because I think it's giving me like a massive insight into like the second century. It's because I like they often just say aloud what we're all thinking, by which I mean like they often like say the logic of patriarchy and like the theological logic of patriarchy in a way that is really obvious. Like one of my absolute favorite like bits of writing, just because it just clarified a lot for me, is this really annoying bit of writing by, again, Clement of Alexandria, so again sort of 200 AD, where he just says that men are superior to women because all people's souls are the same. But the soul is sort of still distorted by the body. So souls are genderless, but they're distorted by the body. And I think by genderless here is that souls are perfect and male, but they are distorted by the body. And so men can have these sort of perfect souls in these perfect bodies and then live these amazing lives. And women, perfect souls that are distorted by imperfect bodies. So he says men are superior to women, but women are superior to effeminate men, because effeminate men have effeminate souls. They are the people who have the imperfect women's thoughts. And I just thought, like, oh my god, Clement just said it. Like, Like, that, I feel like the entire logic of, like, yeah, like, you know, the British hobby is like it's turfism invented 200 AD.
And also sort of, like, nonsensical because, like, he started off with the supposition that all souls were perfect, or that souls were perfect. So it's like, you know, he doesn't really have a sort of, like, right? But that's like, sort of, I feel like that's, like, a kind of perfect instance of someone, you know, I guess, questions about how exactly they're understanding what a soul is, what a soul does. But, like, if it's, you know, something that's, like, sort of, like, right, I guess there was, like, a lot of, you know, discourse or differences about, like, oh, our soul's the seed of desire or what have you. And how to make sense of, like, sin and stuff like that. I don't know. I'm not going to get into that right now. I don't know nearly enough about this. I'm just a fucking, I can't remember what the word is, dilettante that listens to podcasts about whatever happens to grab my attention. But
I relate to that.
But the sort of, like, it's I mean, but that is also right. I think that so much of like gender stuff and, like, shit like that, I feel like, is people being kind of unable to imagine people having different sets of preferences or priorities or interests than them, and then sort of, like, having to kind of, like, backwards engineer, like, well, why would I, from, like, you know, the specific, like, subject position that I'm operating in, choose to do this thing? And they either come up with some, like, completely insane, like, unhinged reasoning, right? Or they just can't imagine it, and so they get angry. Right. And never sort of, like, I guess, bridging to the sort of stage of, oh, well, there's, like, another person here that has, you know, their own concerns or their own interests or their own preferences.
No, exactly. Yeah, and I mean, like, that makes me think again of, like, the Michael Sellos thing of, like, well, why would this child be behaving like this? Why would this child want these things? Like, it must be because of an abnormally large head. Like, that's I really do think about the Clements of Alexandria stuff all the time, though, because it's like, once I'd heard it in that context, I couldn't stop seeing that shape of like thought in like, I guess, like, the sort of background radiation turf lit that is, like, you know, I was gonna say reading the news in the UK, but probably increasingly also in the US. With that sort of, it's that sort of position of, like, cis women are not responsible for how bad womanhood and femininity is, because, you know, they might have that are sort of inhibited by this, but all of that can be laid at the feet of trans women, because, you know, there's no such excuse. It just feels like everyone is Clement of Alexandria. And, you know, and I think about Germaine Greer, who had exactly the same visceral hatred of body hair removal by sort of, I mean, like, with Germaine Greer, we're talking about sort of her visceral hatred of what I think she described them as simpering 20-something gay men who might remove their body hair. And, like, because she wrote really viscerally about that in the intro to Beautiful Boy. Like, it's really sort of, like, visceral, really nasty bit of writing that, like, did me psychic damage when I read it, expecting psychic damage, about, like, the sort of the difference between the beauty of the sort of 14-year-old and the disgusting, simpering 20-something who's removed his body hair. And then Clement of Alexandria has this, like, very long treatise about how body hair removal is evil and, you know, causes all of this sort of sin. And has a really similar sort of visceral disgust. And I realized that, like, this sort of 80s second wave feminist writer seemed to feel exactly the same way about pederasty, but also about, like, adult queerness and, like, effeminacy and maybe transfemininity as this second century theologian did. That worried me, but also it felt I don't know, it felt like it for me, the experience of reading a lot of these texts is sort of like find it's like the experience of if someone's sort of been lying to you for a period of time and then they tell you the truth, in the sense that it's like, oh, I thought that was there, but actually that was there. And I think a lot of the experience of trying to write trans history feels a bit like that, because you're given this enormous burden of proof where it's like, can you even justify the idea that you'd be trying to write pre-modern trans history at all? And it just seems like the most absurd question, because, like, you know, we're talking about Byzantium, where they had, you know, obviously there are a lot of eunuchs in Byzantium, but also, you know, you have things like the founding documents of the monastery of Mount Athos, where one of the sort of iterations of that, the rules of the monastery, forbade eunuchs from entering the monastery out of fear that women would present themselves as eunuchs for sexually motivated reasons to enter the monastery. And so it's just like this incredibly, incredibly gender series of like texts and sources, and then you get asked, well, you know, how can you be writing Byzantine trans history? And it's just like, it makes it really obvious that the question is ideological. But I think the reason I wrote the article I did the way I did was because I felt like communicating that felt impossible, or it felt like it took 10,000 words.
Yeah.
And I had a nice experience with that, actually, because so with the peer review process, I got a really, really lovely, really helpful peer review where the feedback completely got what I was doing, pushed it in the places where it needed pushing. So especially around, I think encouraged me to put more stuff in about the treatment of intersex history, and like it was a really, really good peer review. And I found out after the article came out that it was by someone I knew on Twitter. It was Jules Jo. After the article came out, she messaged me and said, like, you know, I don't know if you worked out that peer review was me, but it was really, really hard writing the peer review to not just write, tell me about it. These are all the reasons that I've left Byzantine history.
Yeah, I can imagine. It seems, yeah, it seems very frustrating. But it's like I said, it's a very sort of solid article. I saw something the other day that looks like it's probably going to be making a very similar argument that's coming out in an edited collection that I think is coming out in like a week or two, or might already be out. Let me see if it's already out. I'll say what it is either way, because I'm just shooting from the title. I'm like, oh yeah, this is probably the same. This is probably okay. May 2024. So that's like that's fucking like academic release dates are fake, I think. I'm pretty sure, right? Like, aren't
yeah,
they?
Yeah. Oh yeah, like, yeah. My main job is I work for an academic journal. They definitely are.
Yeah. So Denaturing Cisness or Towards Trans History as Method by Beans Veloci. In Feminism Against Cisness. I read like the first page or two of it, and it seems like it's probably going a sort of similar direction, but I don't know exactly yet.
That's interesting. I look forward to reading that, because I think, like, the thing that I am going to carry on doing from this article, you know, I'm not planning on becoming a Byzantine. I don't have any of the language skills you need. Like, I haven't learned the ancient languages that I would need. And I'm not. I'm so much more interested in, like, method than I am in the specific thing I was applying the method to. I'm not going to do that. But the thing I want to carry on with is thinking about trans history and trans history method. Like, that's the thing I'm sticking with, because like it actually exposes so many questions about historical method generally, and about what history writing is for. And there's a phrase I use in the article that is just the upcoming one. Just trans history enjoys the luxury of disbelief, because I think that like it's held such an impossibly high standard of proof. By most of the sort of historical establishment who are receiving it, that you actually end up writing history that is like relatively good. And I think that like a lot of other historical subfields suffer from not being held to that standard of proof.
Yeah. Yeah, it's, no, I mean, I think it's a, yeah, it's, or there's just so many, there's so many reasons to say that someone wasn't, that it's like, I think it is often instructive to sort of like say like, okay, well, what are the reasons to say that they were, and sort of let those be points of investigation or points of consideration, I think.
Yeah, really, yeah. Like, there's so much, I also, like, there are some, like, trends in, I mean, like, I was about to say, there are some trends in, trends in how trans history is written against that make me crazy, but then I realized that's, like, that's what the article was, you know, here are some trends in how trans history is written against that make me crazy, but there are some more.
yeah.
Unsurprisingly. Like,
yeah,
I see a lot of, sorry.
Oh, no, go ahead, sorry.
I see a lot of, like, so there are two things I'm thinking of. One of them is the way that we talk about how pronouns are used in trans history. And the other one is reading historical figures, like, so transmasculine readings of historical figures that treat that historical figure getting married to a man as making it, like, the whole thing less queer. Which really does, like, boggle my mind, but also is still, like, I just constantly see this. With, like, the pirates, it's, like, Andy, Bonnie, and Mark Reed, who, where we have this, like, whole question of, like, oh, well, you know, Mark Reed was a soldier for these, you know, these decades, and then, and later on, you know, was a pirate, and was apparently passing as a man, but in between was married to a man that he met as a soldier, and so we can't necessarily call this a trans historical figure. And it's like, I'm entirely willing to, you know, to play with how we read a historical figure in terms of transness and you know, in different readings, but that can't be the reason, saying like, ah, oh, you should have gotten gay married if you wanted us to read you as trans,
you know, sort of the gay marriage. That could be the gay marriage, right?
Yeah, exactly, like, exactly. You know, like, we have this amazing historical evidence of essentially this.
Like, oh yeah, yeah. Two soldiers have never, you know, developed so deep a feeling for one another that they were essentially married. That's never happened, you know.
Well, exactly. And then in the piracy context, it's like there's a word for it. You know, matelotage. I think, like, I'm not sure about the pronunciation. There's a whole thing, you know, about like pirate gay marriage. Like,
it's sort of. Yeah, it's a complicated. I've heard a lot of different perspectives on it. I don't really understand all the nuances of it. I'm not a pirate historian.
Me neither.
There's supposed to be a really good book on like sodomy in the pirate tradition. I think it's literally
I've got that one on my shelf right now. It's looking at me.
You need to read that. I think it gets a fair amount of citation and sexual hegemony. Another fantastic sexual hegemony, fantastic book. I don't know if you've read it, but
I haven't. I'm
oh, it's,
I remember it now.
It's worth it. Yeah, it and yeah, it is really good, and yeah, just fucking good. But yeah, no, it's very like yeah, the sort of no, yeah, I don't know, yeah, that's extremely no, or like it's, I feel like this is like a weird one that makes me especially crazy, right? Because I don't remember if there was like a thing a couple weeks ago, some like, you know, gender critical people on Twitter were like trying to claim that like the patients at Magnus Hirschfeld's clinic weren't transgender because it was like, I mean, it was, I mean, I guess like that was not the specific word but only because they were speaking fucking German, and it's like, but it's like literally like the sort of, this is like a good starting point for like the genealogy of the modern stuff. Like, this is as like, But it made me think a lot about one of those, you know, people is fucking what's her name? Lily Elb. Who, you know, sort of famously there was the movie a couple years ago with what's his face? So Eddie Redmayne, is that the dude's name? Yeah. Where they sort of like play her marriage to Goethe Gottlieb as like a thing that had to end because of her transition. When I think it did sort of have to end in a legal sense, but if you like look at Goethe's paintings, Goethe Wegener, I think was her professional, the name that her a lot of her stuff is under. But look at the way that she painted her wife. Like that woman was at least a little bit of a dyke, you know.
Like kind of undeniably, like
truly an attention to the female ass that it's an interesting kind of way that I think people sometimes read stuff like the fact that there was an inversion. I don't know if connecting this to the inversion model is right, but like people read the sort of like it's like weird that people sort of like think of, you know, sort of like, I guess like being a trans fag or a trans dyke as so like modern, or it's like sort of like having to be this like thing that could only exist now, that there was like some sort of like, we had to like kind of like, you know, get a certain amount of gay liberation to like sort of be like no one thought of this before, when it's right. Like, no, like this has been like this has always kind of been an option. Like you can actually get to this without needing to do, without like there necessarily having to be like all this sort of like work of concepts. It becomes a lot easier when you have those sorts of concepts.
Yeah.
Kind of like, you know, chopped out a little bit and so on. There's you know, it gets a lot easier in terms of just like more people are able to do it. It's a little bit easier to understand, but people got there, people did it.
and like, you know, like with the Byzantine stuff, it's like you've got this really like frequently recurring Saint's Life narrative of like a trans monk. And like, you know, what is that if not transfag adjacent? Like,
right? Yeah, I mean, these places were dens of sodomy, right?
and you have the you know, that rule of forbidding eunuchs from becoming monks in case, and it's like this sort of like double in case transness kind of thing of like, in case the eunuchs are too pretty, or in case you have like. The nefarious woman disguised as a eunuch for sexually motivated reasons. Like, they were conceiving of, like, you know, the sort of nascent transfag. Like, you know, they were legislating against him.
Right? It just, you know, it's like from, like, a certain perspective, I feel like you would be like, why? Right? Like, it's interesting that they came up with that. Because, like, I think, like, within a certain character, like, caricature or sort of, like, presumptive view of like how sex worked in the past, like that would just sort of be too many, there's too much going on, like they wouldn't, there's like a certain way of thinking about the way that people in the past thought about sex that would say like that's impossible, like why would they, how would they even come up with that idea, but like no, like of course there's some, you know, someone out there that wants to fuck the monks.
And like you have the same thing actually if you with the Clement of Alexandria stuff. One of the things that like he complains about in the most sort of strongest terms is that he's saying, you know, you have these effeminates, they look like women, they're leading men astray, and also they're having sex with women, and the women are more attracted to them than they are to the men. Like that's one of the things he complains about.
Yeah, no, it's why do they? Why?
I think one of the things that like got me about the Byzantine stuff was how much of this there is, like how much of the sort of like the possibility of like a trans mag or a trans dyke, like how much that is there in the text compared to like other areas of history I've read.
Yeah.
I think it's just like a couple of factors, because it's like having this sort of thing of eunuchs, like, and having this like cultural presence around that is like one thing, because it makes transition possible in multiple directions and in multiple ways. Like if eunuchs exist, both transmasculine and transfeminine transitions are more possible.
Mm-hmm.
For different reasons, but there's this kind of like there's this weird sort of like lovely loop, which I, you know, this does come back to the other episode of this podcast I've been on, where you have, because it's this thing of this sort of recursive reading, I guess, of historical figures. Like I really like the fact that, you know, you can look at a saint's life of like one of the saints' lives that are sort of the, you know, it's someone raised as apparently a girl and then becomes a monk and lives as a monk, and that's revealed after, you know, after death usually, or maybe sometimes during life, but like in most of them it's sort of posthumous, and you've got two options for reading that story, but they're both trans.
Yeah.
All the people who are really angry at like transmasculine readings of that are never like, no, that was a woman who was having to live disguised as a man in order to, you know, in order to sort of exist in a patriarchal society. It's like, okay, yeah, you've also come up with a trans reading of this. I actually think there are really good trans readings of it like that. But it, again, it's just, there is just this conservatism throughout the field. And I think like by the field here, I mean history, where what people are looking for isn't like more proof of their reading. It's the version of the past in which it's not necessarily that like transness was invented in, you know, 2004, but like a version of the past in which cisness didn't have to be enforced, I think. But like people are reading for like, I don't want to like overuse the word fascist here, but there is this sort of fascistic impulse to read for this like pastoral, like imagined past that confirms a sort of recent conservatism.
I'm sorry, could you say that again?
Yeah, sure. I just think that like with a lot of like history as a field is I would say is often very small c conservative. And a big part of that, and the way that shows in trans history, is that they're not actually like the question isn't, when people are reading the saints' lives, like they're not arguing, oh, we can have this other reading of what was going on here with gender. They're arguing we can have a reading of just to get rid of transness. And it is this sort of like, there's something slightly fascistic about the whole thing. It's that kind of like harking back to an imagined ancient past that confirms an imagined recent past.
Oh, sorry.
Often questions around trans history, like they're presented as being about methodology and about facts. And then you drill down and you realize that like, and the example we were just talking about of like the sort of trans monks that you can read as trans in either direction. Like it's their rejection of both of those readings that like, shows what they're actually doing. But right. I just think basically every historian needs to read Is the Wreck to the Grave and then think about it.
It's been a while since I've read that one. Why? But I don't. What's? Why do you say that?
Okay, yeah, I realized as I said that the connection only made sense in my head.
I'm curious. What is it?
It's the like the way that pastoralism is talked about in Is the Wreck to the Grave is really formative for me, because it's this like, I just think that a lot of historians' conservatism is about this pastoral imagining of the past, and about this sort of like, and by the past I kind of mean the medieval past, but I also kind of mean like the 1960s or like whatever's like one generation earlier. You know, maybe we're thinking about our grandparents' childhoods. I guess like people probably wouldn't describe Is the Wreck to the Grave as a text about fascism, but when I think about fascism, I always think about like the insights in that SS. Like it's because of pastoralism, it's because of the way that like that idea of sort of like justifying things with reference to it being healthy and natural and good and like pastoral I guess I always think about that when I think about fascism, and fascism is kind of what I'm talking about when I'm talking about history's impulse to conservatism, because it's this sort of creation of this imagined past, and it's an imagined medieval past, but it's also like an imagined recent past. It's like, you know, like our grandparents' childhoods is like part one of the imagined past, and then it's like, which must evoke, you know, the same thing that's been going on for 4,000 years. I think like this might be completely wrong, but like I find myself wondering if like a big part of this kind of conservatism and this kind of fascism is like imagining things to have stayed the same.
Yeah, I think there's this want for like that there's like some sort of stability that isn't actually there, right?
Yeah.
Like you know, that yeah, like we could have this sort of thing that just sort of, you know, goes forever and there's never any real problems, and like yeah. That's not the case.
But,
like
no indeed. And I think like I can see like an impulse towards that in people who are like, for good reasons, like trying to do trans history. Like there's one of Roland Bessencourt's lines that drove me like up the wall was and I'm gonna see if I can find it, because I think I quote it in the article. It was something about how if we can't find trans, like we have to be able to find trans people in the past in order to defend trans, like the existence of trans people in the present. I just don't think that's true.
No, 100% not. Like if even if no one had ever done this before, it would still be viable and cool. But also like it is just like a sort of like fact that people have been doing this before.
Like, yeah, exactly. And I think like one of the reasons I loved the Byzantine trans history when I got into it was because it's like an area of the field that is simultaneously one of the most socially conservative kinds of history, and also has some of the most rich like textual evidence of trans life. It feels like it sort of really acutely demonstrates what's going on with regards to like how people are thinking about the possibility or not of writing trans history. Because it's really just a really uninteresting question of were there trans people in Byzantium? Because of course there were. Of course, there were people who were doing things that are very recognizable, through the framework of transness today. And there were lots of people writing and complaining about this. And it's all written down in ways that we can access. It's just like, it's very convenient. But they had so many technologies as well. Like they had, and I have no reason to believe that this was ever used in a sort of a trans way. And by that, I mean a way that is sort of like pushing against gender normativity, but I'm not sure that's how I should be using trans really. But like they had top surgery, you know, that they had a lot of cosmetic surgery in the Byzantine world. They had literally double incision top surgery without nipple grafts for gynecomastia.
Mm-hmm.
Like they were doing a lot of like, you know, they had a lot of stuff. They were doing a lot of stuff with gender, and it's all really unavoidable. And then the field is so like Oxbridge centered and so conservative. I guess it's like it's a very like neat example of what I think is happening in most like subfields of history.
Yeah, it sounds like it. It sounds like it.
Because it's like, I mean, it's like, you know, it's one of the bits of history that a lot of fascists like, right? It's like they're really into Byzantium. Like.
Yeah. It's one of the sort of like I guess one of the first like sort of great Christian. Christian powers, right? Like
yeah, you know,
indeed.
And like I don't know, I think like one of we were sort of getting at this at the beginning, but one of the things that like I find really frustrating in terms of like the constraints of trans history and the pressures against trans history is this idea that trans history find has to be sort of uplifting or like or empowering or good. And I guess like with the methodology of like looking for cisness as like a thing that's enforced, I just like there's so much trans history and a lot of it in the Byzantine world is so depressing and so negative. And I don't like the feeling that I have to I don't like the feeling that I sort of have to be looking for something that will fill me with hope, because I've got reasons to have hope in the present. There's one of the, I think, like, I end on a like in the article, there's a quote from like a chronicle in the 12th century, where, like, just after there had been this, like, really significant political betrayal by, like, a sort of powerful eunuch, there's this line: if you have a eunuch, kill him. If you haven't, buy one and kill him. And it's just, like, it's such a horrible, like, viscerally horrible sentence. And I guess, like, I'm sure there will come a time in terms of, like, writing this kind of history where we can be, like, we're just mapping out the ways in which transness, and specifically, I think, like, transness, like, transfemininity, but also kinds of transness that could risk transfemininity as a possibility, like, mapping out the ways in which those were, like, punished and attempted, you know, and the ways in which sort of various social forces and physical forces attempted to prevent them. I'm sure there'll be a time when that's not the most urgent thing you could be doing with this kind of history, but it does feel quite important right now. There is a lot of it.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a lot of really cool stuff in history. There's a lot of wacky stuff. but it's also not our only. We can make new things. Like,
yeah.
I guess, you know, the sort of thing is that there's been enough human history that it's kind of rare to find something that's, like, genuinely new. But also, yeah, like, that doesn't mean that it would be bad if we
exactly. There's a really fun bit of, like, I say a really fun bit of Byzantine history, one of my favorite anti-trans tracts in Byzantine history. So that's my framework for fun is,
yeah,
it's by Synesius of Cyrene. I'm just gonna find it, make sure I get that right, because again, my pronunciation might be wrong, but it's called The Encomium on Baldness, and it's this deliberately tongue-in-cheek book about how it is good to be bald, and it was written in response to a book, like a speech called In Praise of Hair, and this guy, like, just wrote, and I have to imagine, you know, him sort of sitting up by candlelight and being called to bed and being like, no, I've just got to write one more chapter about how good it is to be bald. And you know, he goes through and he's got these amazing chapter titles like Portraits of Hairy Gods Are Incorrect, The Most Intelligent of All People, The Philosophers Are Bald. And when he's really getting going, he gets into it, and, like, right at the end, he's like, his sort of strongest argument is that someone you see in the forum dressed in an appropriately masculine way, you know, doing appropriately masculine business, but with long hair, could secretly be a trans woman. And, like, this guy fully, like, goes off at the concept of Byzantine boy motors, you know, as part of his defense of the fact that he's bald. Like, I, you know, like, what else could I be looking for in history?
That's amazing. I love that. That's so good.
So good. It's just, like, and, you know, and in the article, like, I think, like, I do cite this in the article because I, like, quite seriously analyze a bit of it, because one of the things he sort of, you know, he talks about is, like, when he's talking about this, he says, you know, and these people, he's saying they do sex work, but they're not doing it for the money. They're doing it to display their gender. Like, and he gets really mad about it. And, like, you know, there's a lot of interesting stuff going on there. And I think there's a lot of stuff that it disrupts some really annoyingly persistent ideas about, like, I guess, like, the way transness in history gets read, and like, I guess, like, the idea that everyone in Byzantium must have thought that this was all about a framework of sexuality that was developed in the, like, 19th century, but like, yeah, exactly, it's absurd, but, like, unfortunately, like, so much of, like, what I end up writing about feels like it's annoying that I have to say it, but also nonetheless worth saying. But then, like, I cite it in the article, but I cite it in a quite serious way. But I just, there is so much like this where it's just, you just, like, you read the source and you laugh out loud. It's so perfect and delightful and bizarre, and it's so profoundly relatable in the present day, but in really silly ways. Not in the sort of serious, dusty ways that you sort of feel like history is meant to be. I really like that.
Yeah. No, I think that's exactly... Yeah, there's... I think that's really, like, there's value to sort of, like, laughing at, I guess, the fact that some of these hang-ups are, like, thousands of years old. But this is, like, a sort of... because I think it sort of, like, gives you, like, kind of, I don't know, you're like, okay, well, you know, this also hasn't ever stopped anyone. So
yeah. Well, exactly, that's the other thing. Like, there are just, like, you know, there's all of this writing, and they keep having to write it because people keep, like, very obviously doing very trans things.
Yeah, like, it's never stopped anyone. Yeah.
And it's like, in a way, it's like, there's something really, really satisfying about just reading these, like, generations of people raging about all the fun other people are having. Like, how dare you, like, you know, be living some kind of relatively fulfilled or enjoyable life. Yeah, and what's more perfect about that, you know, for that than a guy writing a book about how him being bald isn't actually bad, and in the context of that book, complaining about the existence of trans women.
Yeah. Well, I think we've got an episode out of this.
I'm glad about that. I had a lot of fun talking about this. Like, thank you. I'd forgotten about a lot of this stuff.
Yeah, I'm glad you had fun. I think this is a really cool. This is a really cool episode. I think this is going to be a lot of fun. I hope that the audience. I hope you all like this. If you want to hear more, keep listening to the podcast. I don't know. I think I'm probably gonna. This one will probably have come out after a episode in which I announce something kind of cool. Little weird format change, but I think it's going to be really fun. So, go listen to this part of that episode. I think I'm going to append like a little, like, here's what I hope is happening. I don't know why I'm rambling. You've probably already heard this by now, but if you haven't listened to that episode yet, go listen to it. And I hope you're interested. Ilya, do you have anything you want to plug? Do you have anything you want to direct people's attention to besides, I guess we talked about the internet medieval source book.
God. I should have thought of this before. I've got another article coming out at some point in the next few weeks, I think, which will be in Past and Present, which is about ableism and transmisogyny in Byzantium and the way the two were co-constitutive of each other. And if you ever want an example of, like, just a really unambiguous, like, trans narrative about a trans child from thousands of years ago, like, it has one of those. So,
oh yeah, sounds excellent.
Listen to my band Peephole Pleaser, which is actually my girlfriend's band. She's really cool.
What's it called?
Peephole Pleaser.
Peephole what?
So peephole, as in peephole pleaser. Mm-hmm. It's a pun on people pleaser, but we wanted to go with something fun and sexy instead.
Okay. Excellent. I will put this in the I'll put a link. Are they on Spotify or
I've got a Linktree link if that works. We've got we're releasing our it's Steve's first song, right? Everyone else is just playing on it, but we're releasing our first song in like a week or so.
I'll put a link and then people can go check that out.
Well, thank you for having me on the podcast. That was really, really fun.
Yeah, thank you.